This is an incredible moment of celebration. I mean, Roe and Casey were an egregious wrong in the history of America.
This is certainly a day that pro-lifers have been waiting for 49 years. Today's Supreme Court decision was a step to protect the most precious and basic right, the right to life.
The first post-Roe March for Life.
It will now be up to individual states to decide on whether to allow or prohibit abortions.
And now we can really get on with the job of empowering women and promoting life.
Thank you so much for being with us today and for bringing your insights on what the pro-life movement needs, what the challenges are, where it's been, and where it's going. I want to start by asking each of you one question about the challenges in the pro-life movement. Beyond being outspent, if we don't talk about money, take money off the table, why does the pro-life movement feel like it's losing? Kristen, I want to start with you.
You know, I think it's for us, when we look at Students for Life and all that we're doing with the pro-life generation, we look at the March for Life and, you know, and even the challenges of getting people, especially the Catholic schools, to come to the March for Life. This year particularly, we saw. For me, I think the biggest challenge we have is a lack of recruitment and training in this movement. You know, we kind of see ourselves at Students for Life as being the pro-life talent pipeline, but we're kind of alone in that, and that's scary. There's so many amazing ministries, whether they're serving at the, you know, at right at the doorstep, whether it's in front of the abortion facility, the pregnancy center, creating educational resources and content. But we've got to go out and create an army of people. When you look at the history of social movements just in our country alone, the side that wins is the largest side, who has the most, you know, well-trained, largest army who's ready to go out there. And I think with the Dobbs decision, with the reversal of Roe, we certainly saw a lot of people saying, we can go home now. We don't have to go to Washington, D.C. for the march. It's cold, wet, rainy, expensive, and we have to deal with teen drama, right? Or we don't have to go do that thing in our state capitol anymore. And that, to me, is terrifying, because we will lose if we do not get out there and recruit and train and activate. And I think that is the key. If we don't have that army, we will not win, because this is a long cultural battle we're engaged in.
And beyond the next generation, Christina, do you see something different? Do you see an opportunity there that's being missed?
Well, I would say, I think that for Live Action, we do a phenomenal job when it comes to media. You know, we have over 10 million followers across our platforms. We do videos like our face-to-face series, our abortion procedure series, and we have tens of millions of views. But it's hard because people are so divided when it comes to social media, and there's still so much information. Like, there's a majority of young people who are getting their pro-life information and their worldview from TikTok, mm-hmm. and they're watching mm-hmm. videos. And for me personally, I'm just shocked to see so many, even like up-and-coming Black women, who are on TikTok and they're talking about abortion like it's a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard for people to discern and to see through that kind of deception, because these are relatable people, you know, people that seem like they are well-intentioned, but they're really promoting evil. They're promoting death and abortion, but they're doing it in a really kind of a cool way. And so we are up against this fight for social media where people, they're in their little camps and they have their particular political views and they're watching their people that they trust, and sometimes they don't trust us. And so while we've made great inroads, and again, you know, tens of millions of views, there's still a big battle ahead of us, because so many people just trust their particular influencer or their particular podcaster, and they're not always willing to listen to the truth when it comes to abortion.
Some of that has to do with identity. Jenny, you talk about identity a lot and why that matters for you as a mom. Do you see that also as a challenge and maybe one of the reasons that we don't have enough victories?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I would say that discouragement itself is one of the challenges for the pro-life movement. And I think one of the reasons for widespread discouragement is people feeling isolated in their identity, whether that's their identity as a committed mother or father, their identity as a person of faith. And really, at root, our identity is people who believe in protecting the dignity of unborn human life. I think with very loud voices on the other side of this issue, it is easy to feel sort of isolated and wonder, am I alone? What will happen if I speak up? So I would just offer, I think, a word of encouragement to people who might be feeling that isolation and that discouragement about the things at the core of their own identity. And I think, I hope, that part of our great privilege at the March for Life really is to provide a moment of encouragement where the movement comes together. Yes. All of our groups and many others and pro-life leaders and grassroots activists and heroes from across the country, you know, have been coming together in Washington every January for over 50 years. And part of that day, a big reason that it's so beautiful, is the opportunity to take encouragement from being together and to see the numbers, which are vast. Not enough. I agree with you, but
it's amazing. I mean, if you think about, we polled our staff just 2 years ago. 80% of our staff at Students for Life, we have over 100 team members spread across the country, young people who've given up well-paying jobs and comfort and, you know, to get spit on and yelled at college campuses. And 80% said they committed at the March for Life or the National Pro-Life Summit their lives to this movement. Yeah. And that's what I mean, I've been going across the country talking, especially to Catholic audiences, of like, you've got to send your young people to Washington, D.C., because it transforms them. Mm-hmm. It's where the movement can be made. And it's a huge wasted opportunity when we don't all come together. It's so important.
Now, David, you've listened to kind of individual identity statements from different organizations. You're the founder of a pro-life organization as well, but you're not affiliated with any one specific. Right. What are you seeing in that big tent of pro-life advocacy is missing?
Mm-hmm. As I've traveled to 40 states since the Dobbs decision overturned Roe versus Wade, and I've seen people in the red states and the blue states, and universally what I've seen across the board is people are battle-weary. Those in the so-called red states didn't realize abortions would still happen there as people travel across the border, as abortion pills are being mailed in. People in the blue states like California, Massachusetts, have seen an explosion in the numbers of abortions in their states. And I think in the midst of this, what I'm seeing is people realizing we still have a long fight ahead of us. Mm-hmm. I think they thought that Roe would be the silver bullet when it was overturned, and it wasn't. But in the midst of that, one of the silver linings of this cloud is the realization that we have right before us many of the answers of what will help make a difference in this post-Roe landscape. One of the things, the abortion industry did us a favor when they did a big study trying to justify how abortion is a wonderful thing in their eyes. And in the study, it revealed that 6 out of 10 women who'd had abortions said if one person had offered to help them, if they'd been offered practical and financial support, they would never have had the abortion. So in this climate, if we're discouraged, what we need to do now more than ever is provide a safety net of support for women who are pregnant and make sure we're walking with them through their pregnancy so that they give birth to children. 60% of abortions could be wiped away if we make those resources known to the broader community. So there is great hope, but we have to shift our approach, we have to shift our landscape because of what's going on around us.
That's so true, because we often hear, well, pro-lifers don't care about anyone besides the baby. What about the mom? When our Campaign for Abortion Recidivism, our alumni outreach that goes knocking on doors promoting a pregnancy center, what we found was over 70% of neighbors. Now, these are communities near an abortion facility, sometimes in a walkable area to an abortion facility. 70% had never even heard of a pregnancy center.
Wow.
That changes everything. Wow. We did a poll last January. Abortion becomes an 80% issue for us if Gen Z and Gen Y voters feel that a woman has all the resources she needs to choose life and to support her young child.
Well, since the overturn of Roe, we've now seen 17 states where abortion has been on the ballot. We in the pro-life movement have won 3 of those. 14 mm-hmm. have gone down to defeat. But in all of those cases, the exit polling afterwards showed so many of the people who voted to enshrine abortion were not aware of those resources. So right. if we as a movement can raise the awareness, if we can help people to know we don't only care about the child, we right. also care about the mother, we can have a dramatic effect not only on saving the lives directly, but on changing policy and the trajectory of our nation.
Now, from a messaging perspective, overturning Roe versus Wade was fantastic only because it put abortion back in the media in a debate. rather than just as an assertion. And you're talking about some of the policy changes that need to happen. Let's put who is in office aside for a second and talk about the debate within the pro-life movement on what is the perfect policy to protect mothers, to safeguard families, to encourage young people who are scared to have families to actually dive in and be open to life. What are you seeing as the low-hanging fruit of a place to start for good, solid policy? Jenny, let's start with you.
Sure. Well, I think maybe there's kind of two ways to tackle this. One is exactly what Kristen and David have just been talking about, just sort of really focusing on social safety net type or pro-family legislation and policy, it's sometimes called. I think there will be a lot of opportunities for that in the upcoming administration with a president who has sort of blown up Republican orthodoxy in terms of what we spend money on and that sort of thing. I also think, for example, you know, there's broad agreement around things like a Down syndrome diagnosis shouldn't be a basis for an abortion, right? So right. Can we look at that? We shouldn't be aborting baby girls just because they're baby girls, right? Mm. We shouldn't be aborting babies, you know, who are on the cusp of being born, right? President Trump, I think, has really effectively made that point over and over again and been met with objections that that doesn't happen, that never happens, mm. but it does, right? And I think when people hear that that happens, I think, you know, people have share a visceral repulsion about that. So I think there are a lot of points of unanimity that we can sort of point to and build from.
Christina, do you see that there are gaps for people of color that are not addressed that force them into the camp of being pro-abortion?
Well, definitely. And I think that when we were talking about the pregnancy centers and the lack of awareness, that that's part of it too, that there are these gaps and then there's ignorance about the support systems that do exist. Of course, we need to have more. You know, that's very clear, but there's also ignorance. I just got back from Wisconsin, and I spoke at a pregnancy resource center there, and I cried when I walked in because the downstairs was a pregnancy center, and the upstairs was a maternity home. Mm-hmm. And then right next door, they built a low-income apartment housing mm-hmm. with a child care center so that the women who are living upstairs can go next door and bring their kids for childcare, and then they can go to work. And when I asked the director, well, how long can they stay here? Because I'm thinking, you know, 1 year, 2 years, she goes, until they accomplish their goals. Mm-hmm. I know that if I was to take what I saw and I was to show it to, let's say, Black churches across the country, they would love it. They would absolutely love it. They would be so excited about it, but they don't know. Just like I myself, growing up in various Black churches, I didn't know. I didn't know one single pro-life person. I didn't know anything that was going on. Mm-hmm. And so we absolutely need more resources. We need more support, especially with childcare, especially with housing. I testified before Congress twice, but in one particular time, I had mentioned to one of my congressional leaders from Connecticut that you used to fund St. Agnes Home, which is a maternity home for teenagers, and then the Department of Children and Families stopped funding it, and then they closed down after 100 years. But you have Planned Parenthood money. You got Planned Parenthood money, but you don't have money for a maternity home. And how exactly does that work? And so even what you were saying before about policies, I just want to throw that in, like defund Planned Parenthood.
Duh.
Because
number one.
How are they getting so much money? In Connecticut, on a local level, and that's different from federal, of course, but the Catholic Conference in Connecticut did a report and said 70% of the abortions in Connecticut are paid for by taxpayer dollars. Oh, and on a national level, $700 million a year from taxpayer money to go to Planned Parenthood, and they target communities of color, African-American women, 5 times higher abortion rate, and we're giving money to them, and they say, oh, well, it's not directly towards abortion, but they can move money around any way that they want. And so I think there's a lot of money that taxpayers have, and it's going to a wicked organization when it could be going towards support systems
we can make
to
birth
fill
free.
In these gaps.
Make birth free with $700 million.
Yeah.
How would you approach everything that you're seeing coming out of these digital platforms that do single out abortion speech that is pro-life? When you're talking about defining an abortion as something that is negative, how is it that we can in some way monitor or protect that speech without infringing on our First Amendment rights? Is there a path there? Do you see a path, Jenny?
I think so. I think you're right. It's a complicated question because we're lucky enough to live in a country where people and corporations have very broad free speech rights, right? But I think we also live in a country that's really committed to sort of equality of opportunity, so to speak, about speech, among other things, right? So I think there is a lot of interest in finding a way to do that, certainly from some recently ever more high profile corporate leaders, for example, who run digital media platforms, as well as, you know, key politicians. So it would be interesting to see what happens on that.
I think that's the question to ask, is for digital natives who are coming into this as people who are handed a phone probably when they're 10 or 11 or much younger, right? Too early, but that is their reality. Their reality is one that is 100% digital. They're used to engaging with people through a text message rather than a conversation. How is it then that you approach them with a pro-life message? That is salient, that actually speaks to them.
Yeah, I mean, at Students for Life, we have our campus field team. So we're on campuses having those conversations, because those are the stickiest conversations you can have, right? To measure conversions and activations and our activation conversion rate. But online, we have a digital field team. And what we've found is gamification, quizzes. You know, for example, in Florida for Amendment 3, I was on the phone raising money, spending it the same day. Right before the ballot referendum, and we were changing votes of our targeted demographic, using the voter roll, changing the minds of votes, educating them about how extreme Amendment 3, the late-term abortion ballot referendum, was in Florida. Because we know from exit polling in Ohio and all these other states that we've even personally done, no one knows how extreme these laws are. But we were able, for like 45 cents, we're changing minds. But you have to play that game.
David, so then how has the digital reality changed pro-life advocacy?
It's been amazing. It's been game-changing. And I want to commend these three organizations for taking the lead on really engaging with that younger demographic where they are. Going to them, messaging not the way that a person like me with gray hair wants to hear a message, but a message that will resonate with them. And all three of these organizations, March for Life, Live Action, Students for Life, have been exceptional at that. What I think it says for all of us in the pro-life movement is to remember there's an old saying that tactics are many, principles are few. Mm-hmm. Tactics always change, principles never do. So the principle is we have to change hearts and minds about life and about the problem of abortion. The tactical way we do that, we have to be willing to engage where the culture moves. And that's what these organizations are doing exceptionally well. And for all of us, to say what got us here as a movement over these last 50 years is not going to be what gets us to that moment where abortion is unthinkable.
Yeah, I noticed that we get messages all the time from women who will say, I saved my baby after I watched your video, or I chose life after I saw this on Instagram. And it's because they're engaging with real stories. Like Christian was saying, you have to engage with them on that level. And we have a few different video series. One is called Face to Face, where we're putting former abortionists with women who've survived an abortion, and they're talking face to face, and it's very emotional. Even as someone who's heard their stories before, I'm watching it and I'm crying myself, because it's so beautiful to see. And we also do something called Man on the Street, where we take our videos, we take baby Olivia, which shows the beautiful development of a growing baby in the womb, and we take it to the street with our live action staffers, and we show people, and they will say, wow, I didn't actually know that this is what an abortion was. And then their hearts and minds are changed, which is really our mission, to change hearts and minds and to use digital media and messaging.
Yeah, I want to just emphasize, kind of pick up on something Christina just said, because I think one thing we really have on our side in the digital media landscape is that life is beautiful.
Right.
You know, the human heart is genuinely moved by the relationship between parents and their children, by family, by connection, by that sort of thing. So it's so interesting to me when you see something that goes viral on social media.
Right.
That's a corporate advertisement, actually, but that is sort of playing off of that emotional reaction that people have to seeing just sort of moving scenes of family life and that kind of thing. And I think that's a tactic that we can, that the movement does use, and I think probably could use even more effectively, to drive the message. Not even make it specifically sound pro-lifey, but just
right.
to sort of plant that seed, you know, that life is beautiful and the gift of children is beautiful and parenthood can really bring joy.
If I can add one additional thought that I think is important to remember, as important as digital is, we live in this world where we've recognized that there's social isolation. We have young people that are having major problems because they live their entire life online. So we need to combine that digital with the incarnational, with the in-person. That's why we go to Washington, D.C. and state capitals for Marches for Life. That's why we join Students for Life chapters. That's why we get involved in rallies and advocacy efforts. We do these things because we need that human-to-human connection so that all that messaging will land as we build relationships with people that help them to see the beauty, the dignity, the worth of life and the truth, beauty, and goodness of what our movement is all about.
I mean, that's why we go to the doors at campaigns, right? Students for Life Action, we were knocking on doors on all these state ballot referendums. And, you know, we were running the digital ads. We were doing the robocalling. We were doing the texting. We were doing the mail. We were doing all of the things in the tool chest of political campaigning. But it's the conversation. that sticky moment where you're face to face with someone, when you have that mind changed at that moment, that's something they're going to recall even when they're being challenged.
Let's look at the legislative landscape quickly. The idea that there's something that can be done, there's something that should be done. What's the perfect place to start?
Defund Planned Parenthood and debar them. It's something that we as taxpayers will win from, because now we'll be able to have $700 million to make birth free or to give it to expanded child tax care credit, right? Defunding Planned Parenthood would save tens of thousands of lives, because we all know they operate their facilities, many of them in the red. Then we need to attack the largest type of abortion, which is chemical abortion.
Jenny, you've been in government. You were in that White House office and made a lot of great strides for the life issue, but also found a lot of areas of frustration. How much of this is actually possible?
Yeah, so I totally agree. Like, defunding Planned Parenthood is a really important goal. To do that, you have to figure out how to work within the existing language of the Medicaid statute, and then you end up going down a legal rabbit hole that's probably not that interesting to people watching this program.
Them.
But I will say,
all you have to do is debar them.
But I think, you know, maybe the most important thing for viewers to know is that there certainly were in the previous Trump White House, and I believe there will be again, a lot of good people who really care about this issue, who this time especially are experienced at how to use the levers and the tools available to the executive branch to put wins on the board on all kinds of policies.
And in the midst of this, recognize the gift that the Dobbs decision gave us,
right.
Which was that the Supreme Court said there's no constitutional right to abortion, and they gave the decision back to you and me, the American people, through our elected officials in the states and in Congress. So even as we approach these federal issues, each of us in our states can look at the landscape and say, what is the most we can do in our state's landscape to advance and protect life?
Folks need to join us to the state capitals. We send dozens of kids to every state capital to lobby every single year.
Right.
And these legislators are astounded when they find out we're pro-life, because we're the only time they've ever met pro-lifers, especially pro-life young people, the state capital lobbying for pro-life legislation.
Yeah, I think that's encouraging, because I come from a pro-abortion state, Connecticut, and living in Connecticut as a pro-lifer can be really hard, but it's important to remember we have had a local Connecticut March for Life. We're having one. I've been a part of everyone that we've had.
March 15th, I'll be there this year,
Oh, great. Okay, I will be there.
Perfect.
I've been a part of everyone, and it's amazing to see, you know, people come out to the state capitol and to stand for life. I want to say that one of the most encouraging things I've seen in the last couple of years is a black pro-life Democrat who is a state legislator who has come in really just fierce and convinced many pro-choice Democrats to vote against abortion legislation. Her name is Representative Trinae McGee. And so I've watched her go in and say, we've gone too far.
So politics does matter, but the conversion of the heart, the understanding is permanent. What is it that you think the pro-life movement can do to make abortion unthinkable as a one-on-one approach, as an approach from an apostolic perspective, 12 by 12, community by community? David.
I think it's twofold. I think it's first that willingness to say to someone who is facing an unexpected pregnancy, I will help you, and back that up with action. And I think the second piece, which ties right into that, is the ability to tell stories. We need to connect not only with the head, we need to connect with the heart. Example of this, my own wife is a saint in my view, Saint Margaret, and she received a phone call last January from a woman who she had met through a maternity ministry where she volunteers. The woman was scheduled for an abortion at Planned Parenthood, and my wife said to her, I will help you, and got her back into the maternity home. She canceled her abortion appointment. My wife walked with her through the messiness of her pregnancy, was there when she gave birth, and that child is now a year old. And when I look at that story, it moves my heart. But when I share that story to tell other people, we are here for the mother and the child, and we will really help, that's where we change hearts and minds. That's where we change the culture.
Yeah, when I wrote my book a number of years ago, I interviewed Students for Life leaders who had kind of been on all sides of this issue, pro-life, pro-choice, chosen abortion, had abortion, gotten pregnant. And it was very striking. Every single young woman I interviewed who chose life, or, you know, whether she chose a parent or place with an adoptive family, did so because she found one person. Just one person in her life told her, you don't have to do this, and I will help you. And I think the John Maxwell adage of people don't care how much you know until they, you know how much you care is 100% right on.
Yes, I agree with all those things. I was actually thinking the same thing about that Maxwell quote. I think showing, again, the beauty of life and the baby. Live Action has this Window to the Womb web app that we created, and so sidewalk counselors or pro-lifers can actually go online and pull up this app, and you can name the baby, you can pick the gender, a boy or a girl, and you can watch this baby grow, and it really shows you the beauty of a developing baby, and it's important for people to see that, as well as I mentioned with our abortion procedure videos, showing them this is what happens in an abortion. Even the chemical abortion, I've had people tell me, oh, it's just a pill. Mm-hmm. I'm just taking a pill, because they've been lied to. And so when they watch a video and they see this is what an abortion looks like, even a chemical abortion, it is gruesome, it is violent, and it opens their eyes.
I'll just add maybe one more kind of quick messaging point, which is I think it's important when we're talking to young women to just remind them you are so much stronger than those, the pro-abortion forces are giving you credit for, right? We are all about empowering young women. You can do anything, except what you can't do is bear your child and finish your education. You can't have this baby and take care of the babies you already have. You're not strong enough for that, so we're going to give you a way out, right? That is such a disservice to young women who are strong. And, you know, the young women that I met at Catholic University when I founded a pregnancy support initiative there did find a lot of empowerment and a lot of strength in those courageous moments where they decided to have their baby and finish their degree. And I love seeing that. So my wish, and I think the movement is doing this and can do it even more, is speak into that for young women and just make sure that they're hearing those voices of encouragement and empowerment.
I remember I was having this conversation with a young girl in Bozeman, and I backed up the conversation, and I was like, back it up. Do you think you have any value? Do you think there's any point to your life and your existence? And she looked at me like I had three heads, and I had asked her the most insane question ever. Mm-hmm. And that is the crux of this entire problem with this generation, tragically. They don't know why they were made, who made them, and that they have any value. This is a generation of young kids who have never stepped foot inside of a church, inside of a parish. They've never been. They've never had the conversation. We have to stop assuming everybody knows the gospel story. Like, we assume, oh, you know. You may not believe Jesus. You may not want to embrace the gospel, but you know it. They've never been told it. And that's a much larger question when you're having this conversation with young women of, like, do you believe you have value?
Right, right.
And that there's a purpose to your existence and the struggle you will endure.
It's true. I've seen that hopelessness. As I've talked to students and young people and told them my story about my mom walking out of her abortion appointment, I've actually had a few people tell me, oh, I was supposed to be aborted too. And then some have even said, I think I should have been, which is just shocking.
I hear that a lot.
But I've had people tell me that. Mm-hmm. And I think to Jenny's point, it also connects to what David was saying about storytelling. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things to do, both personally, like on my Instagram account, and then through Live Action, is telling the stories. I tell my mom's story. We tell stories of women who've chosen life after being raped, or chosen life after the doctor said, you're going to die, your baby's going to die. And those stories really combat that hopelessness, that loss of, you know, dignity and value, because it gives people strength. It empowers people when you tell powerful, uplifting stories.
Well, thank you so much for this great discussion and for your insights.